Good evening. Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host today, Bob Willard. Our guest today is Juan Orrega Salas, Chilean-born composer, conductor, critic, bon vivant, and a member of the faculty here at Indiana University. Juan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you a question because I want to set up your credentials much better than a simple introduction can be.
Okay.
When was the last time you were in Chile?
I was in Chile a few months ago when the Summit of Presidents of the Americas met there. I went there not as a president, but as a composer. They had commissioned me work for a chorus and orchestra to be performed on that occasion, and it was a very interesting experience. I was very pleased with the performance, was very well prepared, and it was presented two nights. The first night was sort of a private performance for the presidents and their wives or daughters or companions, whatever it was. The audience, therefore, wasn't more than 70, 80 persons there in one of the patios of the presidential palace, which is a very beautiful colonial building, and it was very beautifully arranged, good performance. And, of course, everything is arranged in these cases. I was asked to go on stage, shake hands with a conductor and with the first violin and point to the chorus and then turn to the audience of presidents. And I was told, if the president of Chile stood up, I should go down the stage and shake hands with him. I had never met him. So I met him. He stood up,
okay,
yes.
Good.
Met him. He thanked me for the performance and the piece, and he introduced me to his wife. And then he introduced me to President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton. It was an occasion. Of course, I had to shift from Spanish to English at that moment. And Clinton was a very warm person. He really expanded himself, speaking of my piece. And I had also the pleasure of hearing Hillary saying, I agree with him. So it was a special opportunity. The very next day it was played for the public in general.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And how was it received there?
Very well. I felt very highly honored. And what I wrote, I must say, it's something for chorus and orchestra based on a text that I wrote, and it's called Song to the Mountains, because I thought that this chain of mountains from the Rockies to the Andes is really the thing that links all of the American nations.
You were schooled and educated as an architect, and you even practiced in that discipline.
Right.
Then how did you become a composer?
Well, the order is upside down. I became a musician before an architect. I studied music since I was 6, 7 years old. I started first with my mother teaching me the do, re, mi, fa, sol, and back. And then I started piano lessons at home. Then I joined the Conservatory of Music there, where I continued my studies. And then when I finished high school, I was fairly advanced in my studies in music. The crucial moment came when I finished high school and my parents asked me, well, now it's a moment that you choose a profession to study. And I was sort of surprised of the question, because they had encouraged me very much in music. And I said, well, my profession is music. Well, no, said, that won't provide you your livelihood. Music, it's wonderful. Then I had a conversation with my grandfather, and grandfather said, yes, you know, I appreciate very much your musical talent, but music is a hobby, it's not a profession. You have really to choose a profession. Well, I don't know exactly what happened, if I felt challenged by all those thoughts, But I decided, well, I'll show them that I can study a profession, and I chose architecture.
Is there any reason you chose architecture?
There was a reason, yes. There was a basic reason. I liked very much to paint, watercolor, design. So I thought this was a profession that was going to at least fulfill that part of my likings in life.
Okay.
I must say that the experience of studying architecture was very peculiar. I would say that the very first month of my studies were quite traumatic. I felt very miserable. I didn't want to continue. But as time went by, I became more and more interested in the studies of architecture because I started seeing the connection between the studies of architecture, the subject matters that you worked on as a student of architecture, and my interest in music and mainly in composition, which at that point I have expressed very clearly that it wasn't piano what I wanted to follow. My mother would have liked that I would be a pianist, but I increasingly became more and more interested in creating music more than performing music. So it was at that point, a few months after I had initiated my studies in architecture, when I became enormously interested in what I was doing, because I thought that architecture was providing me an opportunity in a way to see what in music was so tremendously abstract, to turn musical structures into touchable things, into design. I started seeing the design that music involves. Even, you know, when I use the word touchable, during our studies of architecture, there was one course that we had to take that was sculpture, modeling mm-hmm. with clay and things like that, modeling volumes and things like that. And each time I went to these classes and I worked in some project there, I was thinking, but this is the same thing that I feel when I am putting together a piece of music. And it made me much easier to understand the phenomenon of music, the fact that I could foresee a composition, for example, in terms of doing a design or in terms of touching the composition of volumes one after the other. That developed into a very, very important thing in my upcoming experiences as a teacher. Because I started asking my students when I started teaching composition that the stage before choosing notes, before anything, was to visualize the entire piece that they were going to compose in terms of shapes, of curves, of designs, how a piece develops from the beginning to its apex, to its culprit. And proceeds from there. In a way, the representation of the so very abstract expressions of music into tangible things.
Are we talking about lines, and so you can draw a graph of what the symphony
are talking,
or the
yes, we're talking
sonata.
About lines. We are talking about
shapes,
volumes, weights,
color.
When we come to orchestration, we are speaking of color, certainly.
So then the abstract becomes visual.
Becomes visual. And then I started understanding, you know, why music really lives on borrowed terms. There are no musical terms to express, for example, when a piece is heavy or is light, is transparent. Well, we are using terms that do not belong to music. Music hasn't generated that semantic to express itself.
It all has to do within physical terms, then, doesn't it?
Yes.
High, low, fast,
high,
slow.
High, low, that's right.
And so it's just whether it's andante or it's leisurely or whatever.
Well,
the
that
word
has
might
to
be,
do
yes.
with movement, with a movement that it's also very tangible. When we speak of allegro or we speak of fast music, well, I don't know, fast music, what is it? It's not always, you know, when notes succeed each other very, very often, one after the other. Sometimes there are fast pieces which are not notes repeated very often. What is changing is the inner constitution of the piece. The chords that are used, for example.
I can see where you have a novice person who mm-hmm. wants to learn a composition mm-hmm. that where they can hear it in their head, they need to visualize it to yes. be able to give it direction.
That's right. That's right. And let me tell you something more. For example, in first year of architecture, we went very deeply into Greek architecture. And we were taught that the Parthenon in Athens was made on the basis of one measurement, one module, as they call it, that established the width of columns, the height of columns, the same model. The multiplication of the column, of that model, established the height of the column. All the measurements within the Parthenon are the result of the use of one model. I see very, very often in my music the application of that modular principle as an emotivic element that comes back, that is repeated, that is changed, varied, inverted, orchestrated in a different way, but it's always present, and that brings the unity to a piece.
That's the center.
Yes, the seminal aspect of it.
If architecture was so helpful in music, how did you end up in music?
It was impossible to dedicate your strength, to divide your strength, your working day between architecture and music. I had too much respect for each one of these professions to really be able to dedicate the time that and effort that they required. But at the same time, it was the Rockefeller Foundation who appeared in Chile, represented by one of the members of the Board of Trustees, and offered me a scholarship to come and make postgraduate studies in music. But at that time, this person told me, well, and this is the time when you'll have to decide if you are going to be a full-time musician or a full-time architect.
So while you were an architect, you were still creating music?
Creating music and teaching music. Well, so I came to the United States with a Rockefeller Foundation scholarship. In the first year, I joined Columbia University to study work in Paul Henry Lang's The Musicology Seminar. I was very much interested in musicology. Yeah,
he's a historian yes. and yes. so forth. Yes.
And I studied also composition at that time. So that first year was full of this activity. I should have come back to Chile after my first year of the Rockefeller Foundation scholarship, but I was suggested by Aaron Copland, whom I had met in Chile in 1941 when he was there as a member of a juror of a composition contest. He suggested me to ask to apply for a Guggenheim Fellowship, which I thought it was sort of this out of proportion for what I felt my training was. I saw that Guggenheims were given to already trained composers and initiated composers. But I followed his advice, and much to my surprise, I was granted the Guggenheim Foundation's, which provided me for an additional year in New York. It was then when I started studying with Aaron Copland and timely with Randall Thompson. At the end of that, I received a scholarship to go to Tanglewood. So I continued working with Aaron Copland. And, well, it was an invaluable experience for
me. And this is in the early 40s?
44 to 47,
okay,
I was
and
in
Koussevitzky
Europe.
Is still conducting the Boston Symphony.
Yes, at the time I was in Tanglewood. Koussevitzky was the head, really, of the Tanglewood School. Mm-hmm. Copland was the director of the school at that time. I remember my schoolmates very well. Leonard Bernstein was one who was studying with Koussevitzky, and Lucas Foss was both studying composition and conducting, and Harold Shapiro and Irving Fine. Seymour Lipkin also.
We've jumped around here a little bit, so let's hear some of your music, okay?
Okay.
What would you suggest?
Perhaps, you know, I would suggest that the last movement of my Serenata Concertante, because it's a work of which I would like to speak after we hear it.
Let's do that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. We have just heard the fourth and final movement of the Serenata Concertante by our guest Juan Orrega Salas, played by the Louisville Symphony, conducted by Robert Whitney. Do you want to expand on that?
After my experience on 47 in New York, I came back to Chile, and I continued teaching at the National Conservatory, which was the name of the music department in those days. I taught composition and history of music, then became a music critic of a newspaper, which is the main morning newspaper in Chile, El Mercurio. And that was not my last experience in the United States, because I applied for a second Guggenheim in 1954, and I came back to the United States in 1954, and the Serenata Concertante belongs to that period. In fact, I finished the Serenata Concertante in New York. So I'm not surprised, for example, that this last movement, which is a very happy movement, is very much under the impact of jazz, or the syncopations of jazz. Each movement of that serenata is dedicated, or more than dedicated, is a portrait of the four children we had at that moment. Now we have five.
That's it, just five? You have some great-grandchildren now, too, don't you?
That's right. That's right. So that's why I suggested, when you asked me what to play, I suggested the last movement of the Serenata.
Well, what a nice thing is to have something in their memory. We've been to New York, we've been to Tanglewood, we've been to Chile. How did you get to Bloomington?
Well, I got to Bloomington back in 1961. By now, I consider myself a Chilean Hoosier.
That's an interesting combination.
Yeah. Well, I came in fulfillment of a project that the Rockefeller Foundation had conceived of establishing in the United States a center for the promotion, research, and study of Latin American music. Originally, the Rockefeller wanted to connect this center to the OAS, or to a political institution in Washington, which I thought it was a very, very bad idea.
Keep politics out of culture.
Right, okay. Right. And I suggested that this center should be attached to a university with a strong music department, strong in the performing area, and strong in the research area. They made a research among universities that were interested in continuing, because that was important, in continuing the funding of this center beyond the Rockefeller Foundation grant. And, well, it came to be Indiana University, the one that not only showed the most enthusiastic idea of adopting this center as part of, as a department of the School of Music, but also the School of Music that offered the greatest and strongest possibilities in the field of performance and research of music. So that's why I came to Bloomington, and as I say, I became a Chilean Hoosier.
Great. Well, we're very blessed for having you here. You lived in Chile a great part of your early life.
Right.
And there was a lot of political upheaval in the country at that time. How did the politics affect your ability to create?
May I correct you? There wasn't a political upheaval. Chile was a very democratic country, and everything that happened in Chile was through the path of democracy. The upheaval came after I was here in Bloomington.
Okay.
Yes. And I think the worst part of what has happened in my home country was the 16 years of dictatorship of Pinochet. That affected me greatly, in spite of the fact that I was in the United States. And I know I'm speaking of something that it's in the mind of everybody, because Pinochet has been detained in England, and the extradition requested by Spain judged him in Spain. I hope that takes place. It would be good for the world and for Chile.
When you came and decided to be a musician, who or what were the influences that left the mark on your career? You've mentioned Aaron Copland. You've mentioned the importance of architecture, Randall Thompson. But what were those things that helped shape your career?
Well, if we only confined these influences, which it wouldn't be fair to composers, I would say that also I consider that the influences, the impact in my life of certain composers of the past are very important. For me, the one of the most important influences that I feel I had was Johann Sebastian Bach. Since I was very, very, very little, my mother used to sing in the Bach Society choir in Chile, and she used to take me to the rehearsals. And I remember sitting through the rehearsals, long rehearsals of the Christmas Oratorio of Bach. So I consider those influences very important also. And, of course, Beethoven also was a very, very important influence, especially the Fifth Symphony. I remember as something that when I was a kid, going very important.
Because this leads to the inevitable question. How many symphonies have you written?
I've written six.
1, 2, 3, 4, and 6? You haven't
yes.
written five.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. Now, I had some problems writing the fifth, because the pa-pa-pa-pam came back to me all the time. It was really pursuing me all the time.
Are we going to have an opportunity to hear your fourth symphony relatively soon on campus?
January 28th. Imre Palo is going to conduct it.
So the opportunity to hear your fourth symphony will occur on January 28th in the Musical Arts Center, 8 o'clock, the IU Philharmonic, conducted by Imre Palo.
That's right.
We should all be there. Okay. Now, you have a curious tie-in with Leonard Bernstein. Not only did you attend the classes with him at Tanglewood, but there's another side to this.
Well, an important part of Leonard Bernstein is that he was married to a Chilean, and that Chilean went to school with my wife, Felicia Montealegre De Bernstein went to the same school with my wife.
It sure makes a small world when something like that happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Your wife's a talented artist too, isn't she?
My wife, yes, very interested in crafts, and she is an embroiderer and a stitcher, and she's had an exhibition here in Bloomington of her works, and she has worked both in Chile and United States with groups of women, initiating them in the art of embroidery. In Chile, it's very important, in the town of Ninhue in southern Chile, where she developed a group of embroiderers that became part of Chile's creative output. By the way, at present, she's finishing a book on the experience of Ninhue. Ninhue is the name of a town.
A town in Chile?
Yes, in Chile, where a group of embroiderers that she initiated them, and they have kept doing this in a very special and peculiar way, very original, different from other embroiderers, that really becomes an expression of art of that region.
So you've created a folk art.
That's right.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You've written symphonies, mm-hmm. song cycles, pieces for chorus, small ensembles. Mm-hmm. How do you create a piece? What is your process in creating something?
That's a difficult question to answer, because the process turns to be very different in each piece. But I would say if I force myself to find a common features about creation, I think the first thing I always concentrate is in trying to see the broad shape of the piece.
Draw
what
your
we were talking,
right.
Yes,
right.
The broad development of a piece. I think that is basic. It comes before choosing notes, before choosing chords, before. It may be, rises together with the thematic elements. But even if the thematic elements are not very precise at that stage, if only we see shapes of thematic things, it's all right. Once I feel that has been established, it's then when I start working on notes, deciding what note comes after each other. But the process of composition could be very peculiar at that time. Once I have decided how the piece is going to be shaped from beginning to end, I could write the end before the beginning.
Because you know where it's going.
Yes, I know where it's going. Or several times I've written the climax of the piece before writing the surrounding elements, the surrounding gestures of the piece.
Back to your architecture.
Yeah. So I think that's a common feature that I have been strengthening in my life as a composer.
Do you sit down regularly and compose each day, or is it when the process comes into your mind or when someone commissions it?
I would say that I sit down regularly. And I not always I wait for commissions.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I enjoy writing what I want to write, not what I've been. That's, it has
right.
been established that I
so
should write.
So that's your opportunity to create what you want to create.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to something else you've created. What would you suggest now that we listen to?
I would like very much to suggest one chamber music piece that has been very important in my production. Is the sextet for piano, a string quartet, and clarinet. And I would suggest the second movement. Now it's a slow movement.
Let's do that. We have just heard the second movement of the sextet by our guest Juan Orrego Salas. Could you explain a little bit about that movement?
Well, that's a movement that I entitled Diferencias. Diferencias was the word that the Spanish organists use for variations. It is really a movement of variations, variations on a very archaic theme, but it's my own theme.
Okay. In your life as a teacher, what are the greatest truths that you want to pass on to your students?
First of all, honesty. Do what they feel and in the way they really want to express it. For me, the task of teaching is precisely that. First of all, to try to penetrate into what your student wants, and trying to help him in those terms. I don't impose any theory of composition, any aesthetic of compositions. And
but there are some rules in there, are there not?
The rules come with theory. When you study counterpoint and you study fugue, and you know what the rules are for a composer, either to follow them or to forget about them.
And you like to forget about them.
I enjoy very much the forget about
And use
them.
That as a foundation, though.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you allow a student to fertilize their own creative process.
Their own creative process. For me, the art of teaching composition is a sort of a art of diagnosis. You diagnose what the student wants. It takes a while. The first three or four or sometimes five meetings with a student are complex because you are in the process of penetrating what his path is in order to be able to help him. And then you start learning from him.
You learn from your students.
Oh, yes. For me, the most talented students that I've had are those that have left the most useful principles, ideas, feelings inside me.
So they're not carrying around 60 years of baggage, and they can create from their own inspiration.
That's right. That's right. And you can learn from their own inspiration. It's very valuable for a composer to be aware that there are other solutions to music than the ones he is searching for. That reinforces your own solutions, reinforces your own style, reinforces your own principles and feelings in composition. The very fact that you know that the field of creation is open to a variety of different paths.
You deal one-on-one with all your students. It's
yes,
not a classroom.
Yes, yes, yes. I deal one-on-one except when we have collective meetings, usually called compositions workshops, and there we discuss compositions of their own or compositions of other composers.
Back to Bach or Beethoven,
yes,
whoever
yes.
it might be.
Or Copland or Bernstein mm-hmm. or Lutoslavsky.
And what you can learn from it.
That's right.
You're 80 years old. You'll be 80 years old this year.
I'll be, yes, in
right.
a few days.
Now, what do you attribute your longevity?
Perhaps the answer is that a composer never retires, you know. I've been retired from teaching and from administrative duties for now 12 years. But it didn't sound as retirement because my activity as composer continued. Therefore, there is no retirement from the intellectual work that you realize. So it may be that is the reason for the continuity of your physical life.
How would you like to be remembered?
Oh, I want to be remembered, yes.
Just to be remembered at all,
yes,
right?
Yes. The how, I mean, I let those who remember me to choose how. I won't suggest any epitaph in my tomb because I would hate to do that. I don't want any epitaph.
Is there things you've seen, things you've witnessed that you'd like to just pass on to people, that experience?
Yes, contacts with other human beings. I sort of put in first, at the very first level, my own immediate family. My wife, my children, my grandchildren. And now, of course, I have a great-grandchildren with whom I haven't yet established contact, but it's part of my friends, colleagues. And in the field of music, it's not only composers. I treasure very, very much my very short contact with the conductor Sergio Celibidache. He conducted some works of mine, but from conversations with him, from the principles he left by just saying things to me. Consider it part of my own training as a composer, my contact with him.
So he a few words meant a lifetime of experience.
Lifetime. To say something. For example, he said, don't be afraid of repeating in music. Repetition is a very eloquent means of conveying certain ideas. I thought that repetition was laziness up to that point. He taught me that aspect, you know, of music, that you can repeat and always change.
I can't thank you enough for this opportunity to get to know you, and I hope our audience has felt the same way. Our guest is Juan Orrego Salas. And let's finish with one more piece of yours. And what might that be?
Let's choose a piece that has just been recorded and excellently performed and recorded, the partita for saxophone and piano trio that was performed by Eugene Rousseau and the Haydn Trio of Vienna. And I would suggest the last movement also.
Let's do that. What a way to end. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been my privilege. I hope the audience feels the same way. My name is Bob Willard. The program is Profiles. You've been listening to WFIU, and thank you so much for taking the time to spend the evening with us.
Thank you.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in January of 1999. Production assistance came from Michael Paskash and Christina Kuzmich. For WFIU, thanks for listening.